I walk a straight line, shackle and chain. Oh, gruesome Gertie is calling my name. There is no mercy in this penitentiary. Just ask the Hillstring Gang, Rango the Three.
Hey, everyone, and welcome back to Bloody
Angola,
a podcast 142 years in the making.
The complete story of America's bloodiest prison.
And I'm Jim Chapman.
And I'm Woody Overton.
We got a story today for y'all.
Yes, yes, yes. Y'all, you know, we always told you you'd get something different. Then this one is going to be way different than what we normally do. It's going to be more of a story format. We'll probably bounce around a little bit as it goes, but this one really is raw and unscripted.
Raw, unscripted, and I'll tell you this, Woody, it is a historical story in that it happened a long time ago, and it has some family ties, too.
Absolutely, it does.
Woody Overton.
It does, and it's a crazy story straight out of Bloody Angola, and Jim Chapman hadn't found this story, it'd probably be lost in history forever.
That's right.
So what we're going to tell you about today is a convict named Ricardo Escobar.
Right? That's a famous convict name.
But you think about
Pablo.
That. But y'all, this has happened on November 22nd of 1953. Now, it's been a minute, right?
Completely different Angola back then.
Right. And then you think about the Hispanic population in Angola must have almost been nothing back then. So, on November 22nd, 1953, Ricardo Escobar was doing his time in Angola. And guess what happened, Jim Chapman?
He didn't like Angola too much?
He didn't want to hang around. Absolutely didn't. So, on the evening of November 21st, 1953, he hauled ass. He escaped from Angola and went into the Tunica Hills. Now, we told y'all about the Tunica Hills. That's the natural barrier. You just got to be a badass to even go. I mean, they have a public hunting area up there and stuff.
Yeah.
Or a park.
I've got experience in that public, and just to tell a quick little story, y'all, and it'll really give you an idea of the terrain in Tunica Hills. I went deer hunting there, shot a deer, and those hills are real hills.
We call them like mountains here in Louisiana.
Yeah, they're like mountains to us.
With ravines and all that.
I could see that deer run, and go and hit those hills, and I'd see it come up and go down. It was the only time in my life I almost left a deer just in the woods because I'm like, man, this is going to be a pain in the ass.
People go out there just to have a pain in the ass in hiking.
Yeah.
And so it's really wooded, y'all. It's not like it's bare hills and deep ravines and all that. And, of course, Bloody Angola is surrounded on the other three sides by the mighty Mississippi. So Ricardo Escobar decided he wasn't going to hang around. And on the night of the 21st, he escaped and hauled ass into the Tunica Hills. Nobody really knew he was gone.
That's the crazy part.
And the next morning, around 10 o'clock, he came upon a home located in the Tunica Hills, and it was occupied by Virginia Webb and her husband. Now, you talk about rural. If they had electricity, I bet it was a big deal for them,
right?
Much less phones or anything like that. So he comes upon his house. He's like, holy shit. And I've been in the woods getting my ass tore up all night and everything. And he comes upon the house. And what does he do? Well, the old convict comes in and he breaks into the home, right? He fired two shots from a pistol when the night before when he escaped. And we'll talk about that more in a minute. He had actually stole the pistol from Angola. Now, you got an escaped convict you don't know about, and you got a stolen pistol you don't know about. That's a little bit of a problem. Now, we're not throwing shades. It's just the way that it was. So when he fired the two shots in the pistol, one of them hit Virginia Webb in the stomach. Now, how she lived, of course, back then they didn't have air med and all that. I don't know all the details, but she did live. And naturally, she's pissed off about it, right? And after things settled down, she actually filed a lawsuit against the state of Louisiana, stating, like, hey, you should have been handling your business. You only have one job, right? Do it correctly. This convict, not only does he escape, but he gets one of your pistols, and he breaks in my shit, and he shoots me.
Yeah.
I'm suing your ass.
Yeah, and she had some legit arguments, you know, with her complaint. And y'all got to remember, this is the early 50s.
Yeah.
Angola was not near as secure as it is now. They really heavily relied on the terrain, what he was talking about, those Tunica Hills and the Mississippi River surrounding it on three sides. And those were things that they used kind of as their wire.
Yeah.
Other than that, it was dang near wide open. You know, there just wasn't the escape type things they have nowadays to keep these folks from escaping.
That's a great point. And let me go into that a little bit further. Okay. Today's culture, everybody sues everybody. You got all the lawyers commercials on TVs and all that. They didn't have that back then. All right. For somebody to bring a civil lawsuit against somebody was actually very rare.
Right.
There were no slip and falls and shit like that. But she's like, I mean, she, you know, I'm pissed. So I'm suing the state of Louisiana and Angola because they should have took care of their shit. Well, this is years after before this actually came to trial, and the judge that was over here in the civil part of the case was the Honorable Woodrow Overton.
Right. How about that?
That's my grandfather, y'all.
And before Woody goes any further, when I came across this case, that was obviously what stood out was I was looking over old Angola cases, and I said, holy shit. Right, right. That's Woody's grandpa.
And he had come up, y'all, and they actually called him governor because they said he would have been the next governor of the state of Louisiana, but he died like a year after this case. He was a state representative, and of course he was an attorney, and then he got elected judge, and he oversaw East and West Feliciana Parish. West Feliciana Parish being where Angola is, the most northern west tip of East Feliciana Parish. I mean, West Feliciana Parish. So when he gets the case, right? I mean, back then they really, like I said, they're basically nobody sued anybody, and basically these cases got dismissed. Well, my grandfather gets the case, and we're going to go in more detail on it. And he's like, well, you know, the first of all, you know, we got to figure out whether or not a state government can be guilty of negligence in operation of prison. Well, in this case, it seemed obvious to him, right? If they do such acts of gross negligence, then, you know, they can be found liable for it. I mean,
that's right.
He's just absolutely outside the box.
That's right. And negligence, you know, when it comes to an escape and you're looking for negligence, obviously you're going to be looking for lack of security that enabled someone to escape.
Right. And so, and we're reading part of, you know, from what Jim found and what he found, what he said was, well, you know what, if the United States military can be found guilty of tort acts, or even the Department of Highways, you wouldn't think they could get sued, right? Well, they can. I mean, if you screw something up so bad that it's obvious, they can do it. So
Which now is common sense, and everybody, you know, but back then, yeah, like what he said, right. You just didn't do it.
Right.
So, you didn't see the governor.
And so state. This was his reason, and he said if the different departments of state government or even the military can be found guilty of being so negligent, well, then we can hear this case. All right. So, but he said before going into the question of the alleged negligence of the state employees at Angola, he wanted to note, he said it's necessary to note that the physical layout and security setup in Angola. Angola is approximately 18,000 acre prison farm, lying some 26 miles northwest of the town of St. Francisville in West Feliciana Parish. Now, like we told y'all, it is bounded on the western side and most of the southern and northern sides by the Mississippi River. On the eastern side and part of the northern sides, Angola is bounded by the Tunica Hills. And the outer limits of Angola facing the Tunica Hills are marked by a series of gun towers along the levee.
And that's important because that was exactly how they relied on their security. Back then, there were not electric fences. Yeah. There were not walls. And even now, you know, the primary walls for Angola are the Mississippi River and the Tunica Hills, but they do have fences. And look, there's wire, yeah, and you've wire heard us talk about
wire,
this.
Constantino wire on top of Constantino wire, and the wolf dogs and everything else, right?
Back then, not so much.
No, I mean, because they figured, hey, you going to run? Where are you going to run? You're going to drown in a river. We're going to catch your ass in the hills, right? So that's
old
it.
Red.
Old Red to chase them down. That's so that's all they had. And it was a couple of guard towers. Now, what the guards were doing, I don't know. But, yeah, like Jim said, there was no wall or electric fence running along the Tunica Hillside for security purposes. And it says it is very unclear for just what purposes these so-called guard towers serve, right? I mean, I guess maybe a deterrent. It's not like you run away at nighttime. They had the big spotlights and shit. I mean,
think about Shawshank, y'all, and the big spotlight that they would shine, and that was pretty much all you had to look for. It was more almost of an aesthetic thing and a deterrent than something that may actually work.
Right, and so in this, my grandfather's report, he writes, you know, like I said, it's very unclear for what purposes these so-called guard towers serve. Now, during the trial part, Captain Clyde Morgan, who's the security officer that worked in Angola for some 25 years, he testified that the towers were guard posts, which when a convict goes over the levee, now, y'all, if you're not from Louisiana, a levee is a raised embankment used to hold water back, right? Captain Morgan said the towers were guard posts, which when a convict goes over the levee, they can call us and let us know. So they weren't basically even shooting at them. They were just calling in and say, hey, we got a runner, right? And Assistant Warden R.F. Odom, who had been in Angola nearly 9 years, when asked him the security value of these towers, he stated that they're guard towers, right? Percy Tanner, another Angola security officer, indicated his belief that the towers were guard towers. Now, this is all establishing that the state is negligent and
providing proper security.
You got the worst of the worst there, and all you got is lookout towers.
Yeah,
and you can't see them at night.
That's right. Yeah. And y'all, this is the whole purpose of this particular trial was to prove that there was some negligence in allowing the convicts to get out, because there's people that lived by Angola, weren't necessarily on the beeline, so they weren't employees of Angola, but they lived right off the property.
Yeah, well, and the deal being, if you know, we do have some escape stories, and we're going to cover in the future where it involved convicts against the people in the beeline. Well, Escobar wasn't trying to hang around. Right. So he ran all night and got far enough down to this house. But listen to this. Captain McGee Reed, the captain in charge over the security of Escobar, testified in answer to a question regarding the purpose of the towers. He said, well, they were there to guard the men on the farm. Right.
And seems like common sense.
And then the warden Sigler, in his testimony, as well, in his deposition, stated that the towers had little, if any, security value and were primarily useful as fire towers. Even though it seems quite odd for the warden to have such a different views from those of his security personnel, he seemingly is the one to know the security value of the towers.
Yeah, and so I think his point there was, as we've discussed many times in Angola in this podcast, you know, workers or convicts at Angola work. That's right. What they do.
Right. They don't have a choice.
And really, these towers at that point in time were used to kind of supervise them as they worked. Mm-hmm. Once the lights went out and they were inside these camps, the towers weren't of much value.
Right.
They were more of value to see if a guy was still hoeing in the field.
Right, right. And again, aesthetic at best, right? Mm-hmm. So we don't want to say there are a number of different camps in Angola, and we told y'all about that. Right, Jim?
Yes.
And they're all spread out because it's a working farm, a plantation, if you will, and they are spread out for economical reasons and security reasons. Economical reasons being so they can get the inmates into the fields where they're going to be working quicker and back and forth, and security keep them from massing up and doing mass riots. But so they say there are a number of different camps in Angola at different places where prisoners are kept. Around each camp, there's a fence with at least one guard tower. Now, that's very different than today, like mm-hmm. Jim said. A fence, y'all. They're not saying it was a concertina wire fence or anything. Basically, like just a chain link fence and one guard tower overlooking the whole camp. So Warden Sigler testified that the penitentiary is the perimeter of the camps. When the prisoners are outside the confines of their particular camp, the security is a supervision kept over their work. Now, that is what they call pushing the line. And when you see the pictures of the correctional officers on horseback holding the rifles mm-hmm. on their knees, that's what they call it. They are the line pushers. And if you run from that line, you get shot.
Yeah.
But when you're in the camp,
that's right. And here's, you know, the interesting thing. Well, two interesting things there. One, they had convict guards just prior to that. They would shoot you in a heartbeat.
Right, right. And they got off of the power. But this is true bloody Angola here.
That's right. And not only that, and really what the meat of this story is that Escobar wasn't in a normal camp. You might be surprised to know Escobar was a trustee in a trustee camp. So the trustees had a completely different security situation than normal convicts, obviously, because they were trusted. That's where the word trustee comes in. They're trusted that they're not going
to
run.
And usually they had to have been down for a long time and
typically
were a threat, and they had the best, cushiest jobs,
yep.
whether it's an administration building or taking care of the houses on the B-line or, as in this case, even taking care of the bachelor quarters, which is where correctional officers would live when they were there working. You know, single people coming in. Like when I went to work up there, I was actually living in Baton Rouge. And shit, that's before they built the new highway in. And it took you 2 hours to get there from Baton Rouge. So you go up there and you go to work your 12-hour shift and you sleep in the BQs, what they call it, bachelor quarters. This is, to Jim's point, they said, however, in relation to the prisoner Escobar, the security setup seems to have been different. Escobar had been made a trustee and was on November 21, the day he ran, y'all, 1953. He was imprisoned in the trustee camp, which is what that time was Camp E, now it's Camp F. And according to the testimony of Warden Sigler, the security of those prisoners, including Escobar, living in Camp E was that of a system of checks. Trustees, according to Warden Sigler, have no liberties other than that they are not considered custodial risk to the point of having to be constantly on a guard, but are kept under constant check and supervision. In relation to Escobar, Sigler stated that if 2 hours went by without a check being made on him, he would consider it careless on the part of the checker, right? So Captain Maynard, who was the chief of security when Escobar escaped, testified that Escobar should have been checked within every 2 hours during the daylight and within every hour at night.
Yeah, so where they might would check your normal average convict every hour, they give him a little more leeway and maybe every 2 hours. Yeah,
and the thing, too, they're not spending the money on having some, like you said back then, it was mostly a convict, guards and stuff like that. They didn't actually have the guards inside the compound. Yeah. Like the campy, they turned them in at night, and that was it. And somebody walked around outside and peered in the windows. Basically, they weren't even doing full counts and clearing full counts.
That's right. And when you're a trustee, look, there's a mental thing there with the guards at this time that we don't need to check on him as much as we do.
Yeah, I can tell you that I had four tiers, two admin seg and two working cell blocks. And, of course, I did my major counts and stuff. You're supposed to check them. You know, however, in between then, and you call it out, and then the girl in the cage writes it down, right? Well, the deal being is, well, fuck, they locked up. You're checking the doors every time you go down. They're not getting out, right?
That's so right.
Can I tell you I went every 15 minutes like I was supposed to? No, it didn't happen. But listen to this. This was actually testified in the court, and they said, as additional parts of the security arrangement, all right? Now, listen. This is like the Rape Elimination Act to me. As additional parts of the security arrangement, prisoners were not supposed to have access to alcohol, narcotics, or firearms and weapons.
Imagine that.
Well, the deal is, and it goes on to say, the facts of this case proved by the preponderance of evidence at the trial appear as follows. On November 21, 1953, Escobar was a trustee prisoner in Angola. He had a criminal record of convictions of burglary and theft in 1940, rape in 1943, disturbance in 1948, carrying a concealed weapon in 1951, burglary in 1952, and on March 27, 1952, he was committed at Angola. So he wasn't there long at all for a major trustee. I guess they could figure
not
he wasn't
at
a
all.
Murderer, right?
Yeah, and you hear that rap sheet, right? and look, this attorney picked up on this real quick, and he's like, what he's trying to do is paint a picture of how bad this guy was, yet he became a trustee by December of 1952.
Yeah.
He was like, put in there in March, late March of 1952.
Like
so 9 months.
Nine months.
It's crazy.
In December of 1952, he was given the status of trustee. In July of 1953, he was assigned to work as a cleanup man in the Angola Hotel.
We need to do an episode on
the Angola Hotel.
Y'all didn't know they had that.
The Angola Hotel, y'all, was about more commonly referred to now as the BQ or bachelor quarters. All right.
Yeah.
And that's where it's pretty cool. If you're working out of town, you go work your 12 hours, you come back and you eat inmate food. Yeah. And if you don't leave, they used to have a little store right outside the gate with a little where they serve beer. But if you didn't leave to do that, you went back to your room and you had a bed and the inmates cleaned it up for you during the daytime, and you had a clean shitter, and you got you a shower, and you took a nap, and got up, or not a nap, you went to sleep and got back to work. But so they signed into the Angola Hotel. Now, on November the 7th, 1953, 2 weeks before the escape, Captain Reed, who was in charge of Escobar, reported to the Angola officials in a written report that Escobar was capable of working under supervision only, right? However, the record clearly indicates that on the escape day, Escobar was not under close supervision. He was working in the Angola Hotel as a clean-up man. He had been sent out to pick cotton and came back to the hotel between 4 and 5 o'clock.
Now, and before we go any further, I just want to hammer down what Woody just said about the captain saying he only works under supervision, that is the attorney painting the picture of, hey, when there was no guard around, this guy didn't do nothing but sit on his ass.
Yeah, exactly.
And so that the captain put that in the report.
Right. I mean, he's not there for being the best worker in the world. Right. But he's like, if you don't put your eyeballs on him, he ain't going to do dick.
That's right.
And y'all, I want... keep in mind that this is from a civil lawsuit that Jim found. So what we're paying up, even these correctional officers' answers, they know what this lawsuit's about. They're being deposed, or we're about to read you some when they were on the stand in a question, and they don't want to be involved in this shit, right? They want to go back to the farm and do what they do, keep living their lives. Escobar, when he testified, that he didn't recall being checked after that. Now, Tanner, who you're going to hear from in a minute, Tanner, who had supervision over Escobar when he escaped, testified that the last check made on Escobar was at 5:30. Escobar then drank some whiskey and took some dope.
Took some dope.
According to Escobar's testimony, right?
That's what they call it in Baghdad, y'all.
Wait till you hear this. This was inadvertently happened, but now everything gets in, because 90% of everything that gets in, all the contraband, is because the CO's bringing in, they get paid to. This Escobar is cleaning up the Angola Hilton or Angola Hotel, and he found some whiskey and some dope, according to his testimony. And then he stole a correction officer's gun and walked away around 7 o'clock. Now at 7 o'clock in that time of year, it's dark. So Escobar stated that the whiskey, dope, and gun were taken from the rooms of free employees, which had been left unprotected.
Oh, that's
Fuck, they leave them unprotected. The trustees come in and clean it. You know what I mean, that's basically, I don't really get that. I'd be locking my shit up. You might want to plant something somewhere. But they did say there is no definite proof that he did obtain the whiskey, but no proof to the contrary, right? Yeah. And it is definitely established that he did get the gun and the dope.
Yeah.
In the 50s, bro. You have probably wasn't weed, but I'm sure it was heroin or something hardcore. Both were found on him. That's not like he ran into Tunica Hills and found a heroin dealer and a firearms dealer, right? The record also indicates that a prisoner could have obtained both whiskey and dope. We told you about that. There's some question as to the time Escobar was missed, and Tanner, who had supervision over him at this time, stated that Escobar was supposed to have been back on the camp ER between 7:30 and 8, and when he didn't show up during that interval, he went to the hotel looking for him.
Mm.
Maynard indicates that he was not notified, the chief security, not Reed or Tanner, the chief security, Maynard, indicates that he was not notified shortly before midnight.
I bet not. Right. They're freaking out.
He even looked before midnight. Right?
Yeah, the last thing they wanted to do was call the chief of security. Right, so you got these guards running around, and they're like, we need to find this dude,
but
we're going to get fired.
I submit to you, they were like, holy shit, maybe glanced in at 11:45. It's like, holy fuck, his bunk's empty. Where is he at? Yeah. They didn't know why he's talking. And then per protocol, they got to call the chief of security, right?
Yeah.
So, and then he's saying midnight. Now, it might have been, he knows the state's getting sued. He knows they're being liable. So it might have been fucking 5 o'clock the next morning. We don't know.
Yeah.
But anyway, so chief security Maynard indicates that he was not notified until shortly before midnight. And also, the radio log of Angola does not show any mention of the escape until around midnight. Now, y'all, even back then, they had radios, which they would call in to the command center or if something unusual happened. So,
especially an escape.
Right. And so they attained the records and they found it out the first mention was around midnight.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what do you
do in that situation? Well, you call the dogs.
Yeah. Have an oh shit moment. Yeah. So tell them about that, Jim.
Well, there's a captain. His name was C.C. Dixon.
You know that Dixon Correctional Institute was named after him.
There you go. I did not know that. Yes. That's interesting. So C.C. Dixon was, he's very famous. Obviously had a prison named after him. He was in charge of those dogs.
He was probably the most famous dog trainer of all time.
So he gets that call. And look, for him, it's kind of like if you're a weatherman and a hurricane's coming through. Yeah. This is your time.
Yeah, Scott, you want me waking Scott Cantor,
up?
Yeah.
Get up, boys.
Okay. Scott Cantor, you know, the guy on the weather channel.
Yes.
Out the,
that's it.
And it's a little brisk here.
Yes. Yeah.
But you live for that moment.
Old CC jumped up. He woke up the dog. Get up, boys.
Get up, boys.
Come on, we got a runner. And while that's going on, they're still having roll call trying to figure out exactly who escaped in Camp E. Right. They didn't know at that time it was Escobar. Right. They might have not done those roll call checks before them, or it could have been they just missed Escobar completely.
A lot of times, too, they on these unofficial counts that's sent now, it's not like it is now where they have, you know, 10 guys on shift on a camp, right? You're talking about correctional officers. Back then, it would have been like one, and they would walk through and made a mental head count, and I'm sure they missed it, right, for the first one or the second one. And when once they actually made a count, they're not counting faces. They're like, holy shit, we're one short.
Yeah, then, now they got to figure out who the hell is short.
Roll calls, right?
Right. So they figured out after they're looking through all this that it was Escobar, and he was missed around the 8 o'clock count that they did or shortly thereafter, and it was definitely established to be an escape after several roll call checks and checks of the hotel an hour or so later.
Right.
And it appeared that the regular capture procedure at this point was employed,
which
is get the dogs. That's it. That's all they had. You know, the dogs. There was no team at that point.
There's no helicopters with infrared and all that. But you better believe that CC Dixon had the best dogs in the world because they were running all the time. Security, right? You don't want to hear them coming after you. So they go on in the lawsuit and say, from the foregoing, including knowledge of the physical layout at Angola, the frequency of escapes, which was often the testimony of Angola officials, and all the relevant facts, it appears obvious that the state was guilty of negligence in relation to the handling of Escobar at Angola. This is what my grandfather wrote. He said the state was negligent in allowing Escobar to escape in several particulars. During the year that Escobar escaped in 1953, listen, this is going to blow your freaking mind. There were 102 convicts that tried to leave Angola, that tried to run.
That's crazy.
In 1 year.
In 1 year.
Right, that's how many
it's is one that? Every 3 days.
Yeah, that's basically crazy. And, and that's Warden Sigler's telling us. He said the number can probably be explained by the security system of the time, and it was relatively easy for a prisoner to leave. The security seems to have been that he would have been missed in a matter of hours, and because of the rough terrain of the Tunica Hills, could be apprehended by the use of bloodhounds and guards before he could travel many miles.
They
and,
relied on that to a fault.
But they had it down to a system team. Even nowadays, so nowadays it's a lot more advanced. They'll actually have trustees that they'll run, they'll let run, and they chase them down to practice.
Yeah.
These are trustees that work with dogs. And they practice, and they can tell you how far a human can get and what terrain, and they'll set up the perimeter outside of that now.
Absolutely.
And so CC Dixon was instrumental in all this.
Yeah, and there were no cameras back then.
Nothing. However, such a system, in effect, deliberately exposed the people living in close proximity to Angola to a perilous and unnecessary risk. The operation of any concerns, be it business, prison, or otherwise, which creates a risk, danger, nuisance, or cause of harm to another, is actionable negligence. Mm. And there is no question but that Virginia Webb was subjected to this risk and harm and was injured thereby. And then this, again, that's what my grandfather wrote.
Agree with that 100%. And what that, you know, what that case was trying to prove there was what we pointed out in the beginning. And that is they have civilians, if you will, outside of those, you know, the property of the prison, and they're being put at risk because Angola at that time, people felt the security measures were not what they should be.
Yeah, I mean,
102,
100 and some running. I think they felt pretty safe because of the amount. I mean, they caught all these guys or they died, right? But they weren't in the Bachelor or in the Angola Hotel getting pistol and dope. and whiskey. But so my grandfather goes on to write, anyone that knows or has a chance to study Escobar, observes his actions, and study his criminal record can obviously see that he is a dangerous criminal. It was negligence for security employees at Angola to fail to check a criminal like Escobar for near 3 hours, 2 hours of which were after dark. Security Chief Maynard stated that it had been ordered that such prisoners be checked at least every hour after dark. Again, doesn't have a right. I mean, whatever, for whatever reason. And it goes on to write, where a prison has the escape frequency that Angola had during 1953 and before, and where such prisoners were continuously harassing the people in the community, it was negligence for the prison to take no steps towards warning the populace that they had been exposed to a risk created, especially when they could have rung an available whistle. Now, they had an old train whistle, like a factory whistle.
Yeah.
And one ran, they were supposed to blow that so the surrounding community could hear it. They didn't do that even, right?
Yeah.
So, according to the testimony of Security Chief Maynard, the employees at Angola were negligent in not getting all of the escape machinery in action promptly after Escobar was missed. And the record indicates that Security Chief Maynard was not informed until about midnight, and Escobar was missed at least by 9 o'clock. And he said there can be no question but that the state was negligent and failing to keep closest supervision over Escobar while he was working at night alone. Captain Reed, who was in charge of Camp E and Escobar, testified that Tanner was charged with the knowledge of Escobar and should have checked him every hour or so. This he failed to do and was negligent in, not checking at all after 5:30. In connection with Tanner's failure to maintain a proper check on Escobar, we're about to read y'all his testimony in court. All right, Jim, I'll be the attorney and you read Tanner's statement. Now, you got to remember, Tanner's an old country boy, a correctional officer for life. He was in charge of this camp. He's got mud on his face as it is, and he is not happy.
Not at all.
About being there. But really, before this, they had never been sued. They'd never been called up on their actions. So I'm going to read the attorney. It's just a couple of y'all. I think it's funny as fuck. So the attorney says, if that's true, would you tell me how Escobar escaped, how he walked away? Whose fault was it, Mr. Tanner?
Well, they've been running. They were running before I went there, and they still running. Whose fault was that?
I don't know. I'm asking you. You were on duty that night, right, Mr. Tanner?
If you had as many men to watch over at that camp as I did at that time, I'd like to see you watch all of them at one time.
Well, you had too many of them so that you could not watch them properly? Is that what you're saying?
Well, probably. At that particular time, yes, sir.
So, y'all, thus, the only man charged with checking Escobar and knowing of his presence confesses that he did not and could not properly watch Escobar. My grandfather says that was negligence. He said the state was negligent in allowing Escobar to obtain a gun at the prison. It seems undeniable that Eddie Bordelon, a state employee, was negligent in leaving his pistol at Escobar's disposal. So, Eddie Bordelon came to the state because he had to work his shift, brought his pistol, and knew his room was going to be unlocked. And fuck, man, the lock only keeps an honest man honest, but Escobar right. is down for everything but murder. Sees the pistol and he takes it, and they prove this. I mean, it's beyond a shadow of a doubt. So, and he was definitely negligent for leaving his pistol at Escobar's disposal, and for this negligence, he was fired. Right? This
right.
I think pretty sure it was before civil service. And my grandfather goes on to quote a state case that says the state is responsible for its employees. And that was Marler versus State, which was cited in 1955.
Yeah. And so y'all are probably wondering by this point, how the heck did he get a hold of these firearms? How common was this? So we're going to give you a little information on that in regards to the hotel. And we're talking about Bordelon here. And not only was he guilty of negligence, as has already been said, but also the prison officials were guilty of negligence. They had not taken proper safeguards and reasonable actions to ensure the convicts would not be able to get a hold to firearms.
That's crazy.
Yeah. There appears to be an understanding prior to Escobar's escape that guns should be kept in steel lockers or deposited at security offices for safekeeping. No one man was responsible for guns in a certain area. There was no roster showing who had guns and where they were, so they, you know, they didn't have to sign them in and put where they are anywhere. Immediately after the escape, however, a written order was issued and proper steps were taken for security of weapons. So they realized there was a problem, and they enacted a policy, if you will.
It's like I told you, every policy, get out wherever you work, you have a policy and procedure manual. Every rule in that fucking book is there because some jackass messed something up.
That's right.
You can't even believe that you'd have to write this down, but go ahead.
That's right. And Escobar himself, y'all, Escobar himself even stated that he had seen several guns lying around the hotel, leaving weapons where convicts can get them and having a loose security system where such is possible is clearly negligent, Mr. Overton said. And Bordelon, who was the owner of the stolen gun, testified that he was never told. He was never told that, you know, any sort of policy or procedure of what to do with his gun. So that was kind of his excuse. Y'all didn't tell me I had to sign it in somewhere.
You didn't
somewhere.
Tell me not to jump off the bridge.
Yeah. Yeah. So Escobar actually went on to testify that he had taken goofballs, which he had gotten from the Angola Hotel. So that's that was dope. The dope. They called them goofballs.
Heroin.
Yeah, they turned you into a goofball.
Yeah. So he got pistols and dope. Hard dope.
Hey, man, that Angola hotel was party time over there. And so although there was no convincing evidence that he had got them there was no way necessarily to prove where he had got them. It was pretty much known. And actually, there were some narcotics when he was captured, and he had them in a box marked reducing pills. Right. Captain Morgan, no relation to the drink, who took the pills.
Escobar wanted to be.
Yeah, he took the pills from Escobar, and he testified he thought they looked like benzodrine tablets. Yeah. He testified they looked like benzos and had taken them from prisoners before.
Yeah.
So he kind of knew what they looked like.
People probably use them too, right?
Yeah.
And the remaining question is whether or not there was sufficient causal connection between negligence and the injury. And my grandfather said there seems to be little question, but that there was.
Yeah. Yeah.
And y'all, let's just sum it up for you real quick. My grandfather said the loose security and failure to check Escobar exposed the inhabitants of the community in the immediate proximity to Angola, including Virginia Webb, to just the type of injury she sustained. Were it not for the state's negligence, this injury would not have happened. It is definitely foreseeable that convicts escaping through the negligence of the state would harm people in the Angola area. This injury was directly within the risk area created by the negligence of the state and its employees. So that's what he says. So there's an act to authorize the Department of Institutions to pay certain claims for damages sustained, I guess like a piggy bank. But my grandfather said there is no question but that Escobar was in the act of escape in this instance. And also there's no question that Virginia Webb could have received up to the $1,000 limit for damage she incurred as a result of the escape. But I'm going to tell you what he ended up doing ultimately, right? I mean, it goes on the site over and over again about leaving a dangerous criminal alone and him having access to whiskey and firearms and everything else. In Virginia Webb's petition, she asked for a substantial sum for a loss of wages. It was the opinion of the court such recovery is not permissible under law. In Louisiana, married woman's wages are community property and blah, blah, blah. This is all back then, y'all. But I'll tell you, at the end of the day, Virginia Webb went on to say she was suffering, probably was, that for the bodily injuries and had mental pain and suffering and psychotic depressed reaction, et cetera, et cetera. Now, this is probably the version of the modern day lawyers trying to get more money, but maybe she really was hurt that bad. And So my grandfather ended up giving her a $10,000 reward for past and future pain and suffering. And but in the he gave her an extra $5,000 for the mental shock and the anxiety from that from going on that night. So my grandfather wrote, for the above and foregoing reasons, there should be the judgment in this case in the favor of the plaintiff, Virginia Webb, and against the state of Louisiana in the full and just sum of $15,000. Bro, you know how much money that was back then?
Yeah, that was you could buy a
Corvette for like $1,500.
Oh, yeah. I mean, 1953, that was like an annual salary for someone that made a lot of money.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so, for someone that made a lot of money.
Yeah.
They're like making $150,000 to $200,000 a year or more now. Probably is more than that with inflation and everything else. So,
no doubt about it. And to tell y'all the importance of this case and why we bring this to you, this completely changed Angola. Absolutely. After that. After that was a lot of money the state had to pay out. And you better believe heads were going to roll. Oh, yeah. A lot of people got fired.
Mr. Borla.
Yeah, counts increased. They finally had like a book that you would sign your weapons in and out of. And eventually that would change to where guards didn't even carry guns.
Right.
All of that kind of started with Miss Webb's case. Right. So this is something that we just gave you that is of huge historical significance to Angola. And it's pretty cool that my co-host on this show's grandfather is the guy who presided over that.
That was a real treat, man. I mean, you found that. And actually, Jim is the one that does all the research and everything. I usually have everything laid out for me, et cetera. But I was in the studio on Sunday recording for regular real life, real crime. And I was digging through these other papers. And I found this one. And I called my mom and dad. It was about another case
that
we're going to cover. And then we got to talking about this one and everything.
So, yeah. And I enjoyed
it. My grandfather was a hard ass. He didn't give a shit who he pissed off. And like I said, they said he was going to be the next governor, but he had died like a massive heart attack crossing the street from the courthouse to his office. And I think he was 42 years old.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, that was a treat doing that case.
Yeah, it was awesome. Thank you for finding it for me. And a little bit of heritage about
a little
that
bit of hair.
I'll tell you one thing.
Knowledge.
My dad tells me my grandfather wasn't a man of many words, obviously, but my dad remembers him being my dad being a young boy, and my grandfather was a judge on a bench, and he said I had to sentence five people to death in an electric chair in Angola. He said those are the only cases that ever kept me up at night.
On him, yeah.
Hey, back then, they didn't have all the pills. Probably I said, when they sentenced them, they fucking fried them.
Gruesome girder. Yeah. You riding the lightning.
Riding the lightning.
Thank y'all so much for watching, supporting.
Yes, thank you for everything. Real quick, want to mention this. This Saturday, June 3rd, downtown Denham Springs, have a huge benefit for Corporal Sean Kelly.
Yeah.
And today, Jim, you want to tell them who came out?
Yeah, so we had just an awesome young supporter of ours come by, and she is part of the Denham Springs Police Department.
Shout out to all those
women. And so we donated some items. We have some great gift baskets. One of them is a Bloody Angola themed gift basket. Right. One is a real life, real crime themed gift basket. And Local Leaders, which is my podcast I do individually, we also donated a gift basket. Of course, we support, Corporal Kelly and his recovery and all of that.
So this Saturday, June 3rd, y'all, they're going to have a bunch of auction items. They're going to auction off. It's an all-day event. They got stuff for the kids.
Bands.
At least three different bands. I think I know a whole bunch of different food vendors and everything else, and it's going to be a really good time. The weather's supposed to be beautiful. All the proceeds go to Corporal Sean's family.
Absolutely.
And so it's a very worthy cause. Y'all, I promise you, I have a probably one of the biggest weeks of my family life ever this week, but if I can get there on Saturday, I'm going to be there just to go support.
Absolutely.
And so y'all go and check it out.
Yes, please do.
And Patreon members, oh, wow, we love y'all. And thank you so much. We hope you're enjoying your bonus episodes and your commercial-free releases and everything else. And for HelloFresh, let's talk about that real quick.
Yeah, y'all. I've seen some deals come through but we are not blowing smoke up anybody's ass when we say if you've ever wanted to try HelloFresh, we're going to tell you what to do right now. Go to HelloFresh.com/BloodyAngola16, the number 16, and you can get 16 free meals plus free shipping. And the way they do this, I want to explain this because
food is fire. We both had several boxes.
Yeah. The way they do this is when you go in there and you order, there's going to be a little bit of a charge and you might say, well, I thought it was 16 for free. Mm-hmm. What they do is they divide that up over so many meals.
Right.
So you end up getting 16 for free, but they can't. It's like a very minimal charge they put on the front there, but you can check it out. It's almost free. It's barely anything.
Really are free
and it's unbelievable.
The food, though, I'm going to talk about it because I used to do commercials for them years ago on Real Life Real Crime, and we did some recently. And I'm a foodie.
Yeah.
And I love to cook and everything. And holy shit, the first time I got. You know, they give us a sample box. First time I got the sample box in, I was like, I'm not going to like this. But look, less than like 30 minutes, prepare it. What I liked about it is even when I cook, that last minute trip to the grocery store you ran out of garlic powder or whatever it may be, and everything's in the box. You get the best meats. I mean, it's like select cut everything. Yeah. Everything's in there. You throw it together, and the food is really, really good. They put shit together that, like I wouldn't even think – tastes good.
That's right.
And it's all chef inspired recipes and it's fire.
It is. And I'm sure you've seen some pictures we've been putting up of. Yeah.
Y'all
of
send us
our
pictures of
finished,
yours.
Send us pictures of yours. That's a great idea.
Let's do that. Y'all send us pictures of yours and we'll post them and have a fan vote and the winner will
send
get
them
some swag.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Send a free t-shirt to that person. Love. So send it on and whatever looks most appetizing maybe or something.
Yeah, well, we'll let the fans pick.
That's right.
So anyway, love and appreciate all y'all.
Yes, Patreon and until
members, thank you.
Next time, I'm Jim Chapman.
And I'm Woody Overton.
Your host of Bloody
Angola.
A podcast 142 years in the making.
The complete story of America's bloodiest prison.
Peace.
I walk a straight line, shackle and chain. Oh, gruesome Gertie is calling my name. There is no mercy in this penitentiary. Just ask the Hill String Gang, Wrangler.